This is the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things Fem, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, Editor-in-Chief of Feminem. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm going to get you right into Fix 18 content with some new things you can think about in this new year. This talk is called Goals of Care at the Moment of Crisis from Dr. Ashley Shreves. Now, Dr. Shreves is a full-time clinician at Osher Medical Center in New Orleans, Louisiana, where she splits her time between emergency medicine and palliative care. In this Fix talk, she discusses some difficult emergency department cases she's had and how that end-of-life care conversation can go really lots of different ways, and gives some really pro tips on how we can do palliative care a lot better in the emergency department. Enjoy.
Good morning, y'all. I live in the South now. The y'all's coming back. I'm going to apologize up front because I'm wearing a swatch, not a Fitbit. I don't have a Twitter account. I'm not going to talk about a personal story, although I do have one from the last couple of years. I'm going to be talking about clinical stuff, so I'm a little worried I'm at the wrong conference. If you figure out where I'm supposed to be, let me know. All right. So, I'm going to switch to clinical medicine, give you all a break. Some cases that I have seen in the last year that I'm sure will look familiar to all of you. I'm sure like you've seen this case, almost the exact same one, right? So what do all of these patients have in common? They're all critically ill, and they all need decisions made about the use of life-sustaining treatment. And they all need these decisions made like right now, like in the next 10 minutes, the next 15 minutes, or the next hour, right? And of course, these cases present no pressure for us at all in our clinical environment. So it's not supposed to be this way, right? You're hearing more and more about the value of palliative care, and everyone's doing advanced care planning now. It's like the cool thing to do. And so in the future, right, we're not gonna have to worry about this. Everyone's gonna come in and they're like gonna have planned for these moments and they're gonna like hand us a piece of paper and we're just gonna do what it says, right? Well, wrong, unfortunately. I am here to break the bad news that you are always going to be taking care of patients that are at these very vulnerable crisis moments who are totally unprepared, and they're gonna be looking to you for guidance and expert advice about what treatment pathway is most appropriate and what makes the most sense. And why is that? Well, advanced care planning is becoming more popular and better accepted. But the reality is not everyone's gonna do it. It's really easy for me to do advanced care planning right now because I'm like young and healthy. But let me tell you who it's not easy for. People who have cancer, people who are dying, right? Then it's actually kind of scary. And then we know that even when patients do have engaged in the process, their advanced directives don't typically travel with them and aren't accessible. Not every critical illness can be anticipated and planned for, and the nuances of it. And there's good literature showing that as people move through their disease trajectory, they actually change their mind about what they want and what is most important to them. So, I have some advice for you today about how to approach these moments, and it's based on my own mistakes, my own experience, and the literature. So number one, screen for readiness. So everyone in the room knows if you never talk to anybody, we all just presume that people would like us to use all reasonable tools to prolong their life, right? So it only really makes sense to invest what can be like a lot of time, right, and kind of stressful and awkward and sometimes traumatic for families. It only makes sense to go down that road if you think there's a good chance that the patient and family would be open to different goals, like comfort or something else. So screen for that, right, before you invest 15 to 20 minutes of totally wasted time and energy. So I'm really worried. I say that all the time. The lactate comes back and it's 12. I walk in the room, I'm really worried. I want you to know that. And what I'm trying to communicate is, I actually think this might not go well and that we might not be able to make you better. And I'm looking to see, is that a message that they are even open to or receptive to? And if they're not, it's red light, stop. Don't move forward. The other one is What have the doctors told you about your illness, about your cancer, or something like that? And what I'm screening for there is massive denial, right? Because if what you're getting back is totally disconnected from the reality as you know it, stop. Not happening in the ER. It might be that someone can talk to them for hours and hours, and I have been on that side of things in the PAL care setting, but you're not breaking through in the 15 minutes you have in the ED. Move on. And then the last thing is just saying, like, I'm really worried. I think things are bad right now, and I want to talk to you about next steps. Are you okay with that? Are you ready to have that talk? And if they say no, they mean no and move on. Game over, right? Okay, this is one of those do as I say, but not as I do, because I do seem destined to have to make this mistake. On average, now I'm about once a year. I'm making this mistake. So talk to the right person. So very few patients who are at the end of life have decision-making capacity, and I actually now feel like very few patients who are critically ill do. I used to try to like really engage these patients, and more I'm realizing I don't think they can. I think very few of them can. And so when we're talking about goals of care in a moment of crisis, we're largely talking about a conversation with surrogate decision makers. And it might come as a shock to many of you, but the person at the bedside is often not the appropriate legal decision maker. This was kind of like driven home to me as well when recent study published looking at geriatric patients in the ED, and half of them had actually appointed a healthcare power of attorney or a healthcare proxy. That was like remarkable to me that people have done that much. Only 4% of them who were admitted had this documentation in the EMR, right? So be very, very, very careful here. I think when the stakes are high, when you're talking about withdrawing or withholding life-sustaining treatment, be very, very, very careful and make sure you're talking to the person the patient wants you to be talking to. I will tell you from experience that your plan will blow up in a spectacular fashion when you get this wrong. So be realistic. I love palliative care. I'm passionate about it, and I have had to scale back my own ambitions about what can realistically be accomplished in the emergency department in the 15 minutes that I have to talk to people. And I think we're all really well-intentioned on this. I think we have drank the Kool-Aid when it comes to palliative care. We see what hospice can do for our patients and our families. We see how traumatic an unproductive long ICU stay can be, and we want to spare our patients that. I think we're all well-intentioned, and yet we have to be realistic. Our patients don't arrive to us in a vacuum. They arrive in a context, as part of a much larger context, and that might include very different messages from other providers who are caring for them, or strict religious values that dictate exactly how end-of-life care should look, or mental health issues or addiction or significant family conflict. You cannot break through those barriers in the 15 minutes you have to have these conversations in the ED, and I have just had to accept that. I like literally, y'all are gonna think I'm ridiculous, I like repeat the song in my head. I'm like, you gotta know when to hold them. Know when to, yeah, walk away, know when to run. So I know that now, and I get much less worked up. My colleagues will be like, oh my God, and I'm like, just gotta let that one go. You gotta walk, you gotta run away from that one and let the PALCARE team sort that out in the inpatient setting. So in these moments of crisis, when you're having limited time, go after the low-hanging fruit. A lot of family conflict, a lot of drama, oncologists sing this, leave it alone, intubate the patient, move on. And I would advise you to exercise caution if there is significant conflict or prognostic uncertainty. So simplify the discussion if there's no time. So when I am on palliative care and when I was a PALCARE fellow, we had a card for family meetings that had 10 steps on it. 10 steps. We don't do anything that takes 10 steps in the ED, right? So I do, when I'm on my PALCARE, months, I just sit down and I spend like an hour and a half with families mapping out values and doing all that. You can't do it in the ED, and I have finally had to just accept that. I don't have the patience. I'm very distracted. I'm too stressed, and I can't do it, particularly because this patient's like in front of me on BiPAP, and I need to know right now what to do. At the same time, I still want to be as clear as possible in my communication, and I want people to know they have options. So what I now do for a lot of these patients is I give them three pathways. I say, You got three options here: the comfort, the non-invasive, and the invasive. There's three pathways. So some people in this situation would say, you know what? It's most important to me to live as long as possible. And so that would mean putting me on machines, even if it's uncomfortable, even if there's a high chance that it won't work, that's okay. That's what's most important. Just try to keep me alive as long as possible. Other people in this situation say, you know what? I do want a chance at getting better. So IV fluids and antibiotics, things like that, I'd be okay with that. But if I get worse, I don't want invasive, heroic things. And instead, then I would want you to focus on my comfort and allow me to die naturally. And still other people would say, you know what, at this point in my illness, I really just want you to keep me comfortable and allow me to die. All three of those are totally normal and appropriate. If your mom was sitting here, what would she say? So that took like what, a minute and a half, right? It's not perfect, but perfect is the enemy of good, and that's like the rule I live by in my life. So I think that it's better than nothing, and it's better than asking if you want everything done. And realistically, in these moments of crisis, this is typically what I do, something along those lines. Obviously, if you can explore quality of life issues, it's always best to take the time to do it. And sometimes you will have the time, because sometimes I have the time, but I don't always. And why is this important? Well, patients have told us, and the literature very much supports this, that this is the most important issue for them when they're considering what treatments they would want. The challenge is we are really bad at prognosticating in the first minutes or hour of someone's acute illness. When somebody comes in with a massive stroke, I'm sure you've all been shocked sometimes at the remarkable recovery they make 3 to 6 months later. So I can't always say what things are going to look like in the back end. I almost never can. But I can explore what somebody's current quality of life is like. And I can ask a lot of questions about that. How would you describe your quality? What would he say if he could tell me about his current quality of life? I've gotten things back a couple weeks ago. Someone said, you know what? He would say this is his worst nightmare. I said, okay. Well, that I can work with that, right? So what I do know is that if the current quality of life is not acceptable, I do know on the back end of a critical illness that it will be worse, right? And so again, if I'm getting a lot of information about the quality of life is not good, it's not acceptable, then I can use that as a starting off point. So empathy is essential. I know I am preaching to the choir in this large room of women, but this is really important. I think that the road to that moment that people have with us, this very intense moment, is often paved with blood, sweat, and tears in ICUs, in rehabs, in chemo suites. And I think it just can be incredibly validating to acknowledge that, to acknowledge the journey that has taken them to this moment with us and how hard it has been. And, you know, I will like look at these charts and go in the room and I'm like, I just read this chart. I'm like, how are you like standing? I'm exhausted just reading the chart of what has like, you know, taken you to this point. And just sort of acknowledging that I think can be very validating for patients because it's true, right? It's true. And then I think also just recognizing the pain and the suffering and the sadness and the grief that comes with having a loved one at the end of life or having somebody with a serious illness. So there's sort of the humanistic part of like why that's important to do because, you know, you're just a good person. And then there is the other part, which is people need to make medical decisions in these moments. And a lot of people cannot do the hard cognitive work of making medical decisions until they have been given the space by us to process the emotional component. And then this is sort of the last and I think the most important message I have, which is find some humility. So park your judgment at the door. So it gets harder and harder for me to hear colleagues and other providers say things like, oh, like if I was the patient in bed one, I'd have DNR tattooed on my, you know, vocal cords, or, you know, I would never want to be intubated in this situation. Like that family's crazy. I can't believe they're still getting chemo, blah, 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 blah. One of the reasons is it makes me cringe is because I know I have said those words many times and I am so ashamed to do it. I think that we judge our patients and we judge their choices, and it makes it very hard to actually align with them and advocate for them and guide them in the way they actually need us to do. And then the other problem with it is that we're totally full of shit. So a study was actually published by a former colleague of mine who's such a quiet rebel. There was this like male emergency physician who had written this article, this blog that was really very popular. Like, physicians would never choose these things that our patients choose. And so she was like, oh, we'll just study that. Okay. So they looked at how doctors die. Do we die differently than our patients? Is that actually true? So it turns out we die exactly the same as our patients do. We use hospice a little bit more. And when I say a little more, I mean 46 versus 43%. We spend just as many days in the ICU at the end of life. We spend just as many days in the hospital. So remember that. Next time you're judging your patient, you would probably be struggling with the exact same thing. At least the literature suggests that that is true. And a reminder, again, that prognostication is a hard and an inexact science. So be very, very careful when you're very certain about how somebody's going to do in the ED in the first minutes to hours of their illness. Because I am telling you from my own experience, I have been proven wrong way more than I've been proven right. Your patients are going to surprise you. So how did these patients do? It was all over the map, right? So this guy here at the top, he was about to go to the OR, and I asked his wife the quality of life question, and she said, oh, quality of life? He would say he has no quality of life. And I said, well, let's stop the trip to the OR and have a talk. And so we got him to inpatient hospice. This next family, well, she had just gotten the diagnosis a month before. They were totally unprepared, and they were in shock, and actually sort of interested in having a comfort-oriented approach. But then, you know what? The oncologist called them on their cell phone and said, do not stop fighting. So in the 3 hours into the ED stay, I then had to intubate her, and then she coded a couple hours later, and I had to code her. So sometimes that's what it looks like, right? So this guy, his son is a friend of mine, and I ended up having to intubate him. His dad came in. He was super, super sick, and I was just certain that he was going to spend the rest of his life, and we were actually thinking about not intubating him. His son was actually thinking about just focusing on his comfort. He has made a full recovery, and his son says he has a better personality than he did before stroke. And this patient, the family said, we want to do that middle pathway you just mentioned. We kind of want to see if he can get better, but we don't want to escalate. And so we admitted him on BiPAP, no escalation planned, and 2 days later, he didn't get better, so they went home with hospice. And this patient here, I got her to inpatient hospice, but on my second ED visit with her. And the first one, she disenrolled, and we admitted her. And then 3 days later, when she was in triage again, they were like, Dr. Shreves, we need you to see this patient again. And so I came in, and we sat down with the family again, and we eventually got her to inpatient hospice, but not after she had initially disenrolled in hospice because they weren't ready. And then, of course, this one. I'm sorry, but at 99, when you have a perf viscous, isn't it game over? I mean, I went in the room, and I was like, looked at her, and I said, you know, I think, you know, I mean, like, it's got to be, right? And she said, I hear what you're saying, I hear what you're saying. She goes, if the good Lord is ready to take me, then he can just do it on the operating table. I said, I don't even know what to say, but okay. And the surgeon's like, I'm willing. I was like, go for it. And she, like, moved to Colorado with her daughter and is like, started a new life. So there you go. So my message is, if you maintain an open mind, an open heart, and a lot of humility, I think engaging in these moments can be some of the most surprising and interesting and rewarding work that we do. Thank you.